from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Massive anti-government protests continued over the weekend in Venezuela, which faces food shortages and record-high inflation. Coming up, we'll get the latest on the crisis there. Then at 9:30, former Acting Attorney General Sally Yates is set to testify today before a Senate subcommittee on Russian interference in the 2016 election. We'll talk with California Congressman Adam Schiff, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, which is also probing President Trump's alleged Russia ties.
I'm pleased to say that our investigation is back on track.
That's next on Forum, after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Mass civil unrest in Venezuela has left at least 30 dead and more than 400 injured over the last month as government forces crack down on protesters, demanding relief from hyperinflation and acute food, water, and electricity shortages. Meanwhile, President Nicolas Maduro has sparked a constitutional crisis in his move to dissolve the National Assembly, rewrite the Constitution, and consolidate power. We discuss the worsening political and economic crisis in Venezuela and the effects on its people. Joining me from Caracas this morning is Anatoly Kurmanayev, and he is a reporter of The Wall Street Journal. He's based in Caracas, and we welcome you to the program.
Hi, Van.
Good to have you. Also want to welcome Daniel Landsberg-Rodriguez, who is an adjunct lecturer of finance at Northwestern University, also a columnist for the Venezuelan newspaper El Nacional. And let me go first, if I may, to you, Anatoly Kurmanayev. Presently, there's a great deal of concern about what seems to be catastrophic and in crisis there, but especially over the escalating violence. What's the situation like presently?
The process pretty much daily all across Venezuela. Some are planned, like right now, as we speak. Opposition supporters are gathering in eastern Caracas, also in various parts and in major cities. And more sporadic, more sort of violent, chaotic moments as well of various lootings and just general chaos. Very, very volatile, unstable situation here.
And these are even in the working class neighborhoods that were really pro-Chavez and so strongly behind Chavez before he died and Maduro took over, right?
That's right, yeah. The geography of protest today is very different from what it was in the last wave of unrest against the government in 2014. It's not just a middle-class area that are protesting. It's the lower-class areas, the lower-middle-class, all across the country, in municipalities that are controlled by the government as well. So it's much harder for the government to control and to keep a lid on this than it has been before.
Well, that's especially true in light of what the government has done with the National Assembly and presently this ongoing constitutional crisis. That's even escalated the protests, has it?
That was a trigger. The political reasons for this have been the spark, but the deep root of this is the economic of the country. Inflation is at about 500% a year, drastic shortages of food, of medicine, people not getting enough to eat, can't find any work to do, and that's what really driving the process. And until the government resolves that, no amount of repression is going to be able to stop a protest.
Well, food is not coming in. I know there are shortages of medicine and electricity, but the reality is that there's almost starvation going on, I'm reading.
We are not yet at the level of sub-Saharan Africa, but remember that Venezuela was a wealthy country. It was the wealthiest country in South America even a decade ago, and malnutrition.
I think we may have lost the connection, but let me just extend my thanks to Anatoly Kurmanayev. And again, he's a reporter of The Wall Street Journal in Caracas. I want to go to Daniel Landsberg-Rodriguez, who's with us from Chicago, adjunct lecturer, finance at Northwestern, and also columnist for the Venezuelan newspaper El Nacional. Let's talk about the economic situation, if we could, with you, Daniel Landsberg-Rodriguez. I mean, certainly the price of oil has a great deal to do with this, but there are other financial factors. There's tremendous indebtedness now, and the inflation is running higher than almost anywhere in the world.
Yes. Thank you, Michael, for having me on the show. Venezuela's problems are not coming out of nowhere. Unfortunately, during the largest oil windfall in the nation's history over the last 10 years, prior to the fall of oil prices in the final quarter of 2015, Venezuela brought in a lot of money, but actually still ended up spending significantly more than it was taking in. Essentially, the revolution was able to maintain legitimacy despite, or at least popular support, despite strong-arm majoritarian tactics, running rampant across a separation of powers issues, essentially taking the voice away from political minorities, somewhat isolating itself from at least the OECD countries, but it was able to justify these by sort of lavish projects, both nationally and internationally. You had a great deal of money that went into funding projects in other countries to sort of export Venezuela's national brands and make what was, even as a wealthy country, still a mid-sized, middle-income country, into a global player, albeit ephemerally, during the late 2000s. That money now is gone. After over $1 trillion coming in from high oil prices before, you now have $10 billion left in national reserves, much of which disappeared to sort of export these foreign policy initiatives, like subsidized oil to New York, to Boston, to a lot of Caribbean countries, for example, through Citgo and Petrocaribe, and also for electoral purposes, when spending would go up, Chavez got in the habit of taking out loans, sometimes through the bond market and sometimes through oil for cash deals to China.
And there's huge indebtedness there. I mean, let's talk about that just for a moment, because they're sending so many barrels of oil to China now just to try to pay off the debt.
That's absolutely correct. And in a sense, it exacerbates the issues on the ground. Venezuela's problems with an undiversified economy actually predate Chavez considerably. Given the flow of oil rents and the higher standard of living Venezuela had for a long time vis-a-vis its neighbors, labor prices tended to be higher. So it was never able to develop, for example, agricultural industries, pharma industries, to a point where it was self-sufficient. That meant that foreign exchange and international currency was required under Venezuela's currency controls to allow importers to bring in food so that the population could have something to eat.
Yeah, but they're not getting food in now. I mean, they're having a difficult time importing food even now, yeah?
Because there's less money now, and since some of that money has to go to pay Wall Street, and another chunk of it is never turned into money because oil that would otherwise go to market is being sent to China to pay off debts that have already been incurred and that have already been spent, that creates a situation where the government has to choose whether to pay Wall Street and China off or to import sufficient foods and medicines so that the population can remain on its feet. And it has, up to this point, opted for the former, thinking that it would be too destabilizing for Venezuela to undergo a default, given the other conditions on the street.
Daniel, let me interrupt you for a minute, because this is a half-hour segment. I want to give listeners an opportunity to ask questions and bring in their own thoughts and opinions. So let me do that now. In fact, let me tell you how you can join the program. This is an ongoing serious crisis, to put it mildly, in Venezuela under the Maduro administration. One of the big puzzles is why more of the military and political elite, we can perhaps go into that too, but have not joined forces against Maduro, because the protests are going on in the streets and the inflation is just continuing to go up higher than just about anywhere in the world. Let me invite you to join us if you have some thoughts or if you have some questions. We want to hear from you, and our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join the program now with any questions or comments you might have about Venezuela. Venezuela as a national crisis deepens and government cracks down on protesters. Again, our toll-free number for your calls, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum at kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply clicking on this segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at kqedforum. We spoke earlier with Anatoly Kermaneyev, who is a reporter of the Wall Street Journal based in Caracas, and now we have Daniel Landsberg-Rodriguez on the line, and we certainly welcome you to join us on the line as well. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Maduro did raise the hourly wage just recently, Daniel Landsberg-Rodriguez, but that's not going to really make much impact, is it?
No, because essentially what he's doing is choosing various sectors, for example, the military, government workers, the last sectors that still support the revolution politically, and trying to essentially make it so that they're not net losers given the high inflation, to shield them somewhat from that. But since there isn't enough capital available to shield everyone, and there isn't a strong enough policy mechanism or in place or even in discussion to actually curtail inflation, these are stopgap measures, which, as you mentioned earlier, are aimed largely at keeping support within the sectors of society that that Maduro is increasingly dependent on, the military, certain parts of the financial elite that are well-connected and somewhat dependent on the government, and, you know, certain government bureaucrats that basically the government feels it can survive if it has the bureaucracy, some segment of the wealthy, and then the military. And thus far, it has been able to, despite 80% of the population wanting elections to be able to take the country in a new direction.
Yeah, you have to wonder when those members of the elite, or whatever you want to call them, are going to defect and go along with the population. Looking at a comment here from a listener named Jake, who writes, leadership change is critical even in a socialist country. Maduro has nothing to offer the Venezuelan people. He's just sitting on the economy and stifling it. If a leader won't acknowledge the need for term limits, it's because they have something to hide. Well, the fact of the matter is this new attempt to essentially re-rig the Constitution and to essentially also change the whole nature of the National Assembly, as I kind of indicated earlier when we spoke to Anatoly Kermaneyev, suggests that Maduro is trying to do some hijinks here that probably are not going to work.
Well, constitutional reforms of this nature have been quite common in Venezuela's history. If Maduro does manage to refit the constitution, it would be the 27th time in the country's history that a constitution has been rewritten rather than amended. The constitution's only been amended 3 times, but they've been rewritten entirely 26 times. It creates a situation, however, where...
But forgive me, Daniel, he's trying to shut out the opposition here. That seems patently clear, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. But what is interesting is that using the courts, given that Venezuela's constitution is only a teenage constitution and doesn't have a lot of precedence, he has been able, through a pliant and sort of personally packed Supreme Court, interpret laws that have no precedent completely in the government's favor, to the point that the opposition supermajority in parliament has yet to be able to pass any laws. So essentially, he's already managed to sideline the opposition outside of being an opposition sounding chamber and something of a standard bearer for an alternative. So this constitutional referendum, there's two interpretations of what it could be. One is that the government, by confusing everyone, has actually tended to get away with quite a bit. Because since there's very little opposition media available, most of the major publications have been co-opted or bought directly by the government. There's different versions of what's going on. So when you mentioned, for example, that constitutional reform would by nature sideline the national parliament, which is opposition controlled as of 2 years ago or over a year ago, that's something that is not actually clear. Depending on who you ask within the government, that may or may not be an aim. And these sorts of uncertainties make it very difficult for the opposition to coordinate effectively despite having a very clear majority of the popular will, and despite the fact that this government has taken what was once a thriving country and run it into the ground.
All right, let me bring in our callers. And by the way, you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. And here's Saul, who has a kind of different view of what might be going on in Venezuela. Saul, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have relatives in Venezuela, and there is among them a widely held belief that what is happening in Venezuela is manufactured or at least presented in a similar way that that it was done in Chile, and that is used a way to justify an eventual intervention by the U.S. And I wanted to find out what your experts have to say about that.
Well, let me go to Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez on that theory of manufactured dissent in Venezuela and ongoing catastrophic crises to pretty much bring in American intervention.
Well, that has been the government's claim now for a very long time, sort of linking the current problems in Venezuela to what we saw during the Allende years, prior to the coup in Chile in the 70s. Where I think there are some important differences, however, is in the fact that if, just objectively speaking, if it were to be an intervention, it makes very little sense to do it now. Just from a geopolitical sense, Venezuela used to be a bit of a foil to George W. Bush. You had a majority of OAS countries during the years in which Venezuela could export a lot of oil, subsidized, voting Venezuela's way, which helped serve as a springboard, for example, to China's further involvement in South America, to have more of an opposition to the United States in its own backyard. But Venezuela's days of being able to do that are largely behind it. Essentially, the only risk that Venezuela could to the United States now would be if conditions continue as they are, you would have a failed state with roughly the population of Canada and twice its oil reserves in a region with very volatile borders and that border important allies like Brazil and Colombia. So in a sense, it makes that some of these conspiracy theories, even if they were true, the timing is very odd for it to be taking place now. And when you see the masses of people on the streets, the coup that took place in Chile was the military and some of Congress and some of the courts undermining the government. Right now, you have the opposite. The military and the courts are the only thing that's keeping the government on the ground, whereas the population is what's rejecting it, which would be a very novel way to engineer a coup.
And again, we're talking to Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez, adjunct lecturer in finance at Northwestern and also columnist for the Venezuelan newspaper El Nacional. A tweet from Bonnie, who says, people are watching their children starve because of the government. They will not stop. And let me bring another caller on. That's Casey. Casey, good morning. You're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make the comment that I actually lived in Venezuela. I was in high school. My father was an engineer with an oil company. And we were there when Chavez got elected. And the difference between pre-Chavez and post-Chavez was night and day just in a couple of months. And the amount of like anti-capitalism and anti-international influence rhetoric that happened really shifted the way that companies could invest and do business in Venezuela. So you had Venezuela taking back control over oil fields. All these companies were losing their investment. And so my comment is, and question to your expert, unless Venezuela actually gets out this regime and can accept influence and investment from international parties, how are they ever going to actually be able to compete and exist on the international stage and get
It's an important question, Casey, and I thank you for it. I mean, how can Venezuela maintain the kind of Chavez ideology without Chavez's charisma or, for that matter, the kind of leadership that he had and with all the oil prices continuing to plummet? I don't know if it's even possible, but Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez, let's hear you opine.
Well, it's a fantastic question, and it's one I know that many people both inside and outside of Venezuela are struggling with now. On some level, if oil prices were to go back to, overnight somehow, to 100, 120, the government may be able to stabilize by just being able to, despite its increasing debts, start to import food. Again, start to import sufficient food and medicines. Much of the anger against the system that is political comes from the middle class and has been there for a long time. But the danger posed to the government by having protests spread into more lower class areas is largely based on economic deprivation. At the same time, you do have a situation in Venezuela where the regime itself has become toxic to investment. The deals that it can strike are deals that are not the deals it used to be able to strike, which have a great deal of risk priced in. There were a great deal of expropriations of various oil projects, international companies, and these have made it very difficult to find conventional investors, despite Venezuela's abundant mineral wealth. Getting outside of that would probably require a government change. If we look at what happened in Argentina, for example, once the Kirchners left, while the country was in default, just the election of Mauricio Macri was able to allow Argentina to essentially release a new bond before it had even paid off the old one, just because of the facelift that came with having a new government in place. At the same time, Venezuela now has another resource that I think may be more important to it moving forward than oil itself is. This resource is actually the diaspora. You have had now 10, 15 years of Venezuela's educated class moving abroad, going to places like Houston, like Colombia, like New York, Miami, Madrid, and all of these now can become something of a resource because you now have a population that has international know-how, international currency, international connections that may be able to bring investment back, which is what we saw, for example, in the Dominican Republic after the end of the Trujillo years when the Washington Heights investments started coming in. And we're even seeing in Cuba now, in which many of the first movers for reintegration to the Cuban economy are the kids and grandkids of people who fled. So those connections are there, and that may be, I think, one of the few silver linings to what has really been the destruction of a country under the current regime.
Well, Daniel, we have seconds left here. What should be the U.S. role in all this? There's been some humanitarian aid, millions of dollars of humanitarian aid. What more can or should the U.S. do from your perspective?
Well, the humanitarian aid issue is a thorny one. The government has deliberately eschewed international aid on principle, viewing it as essentially a way for imperialism to put its tentacles into the country itself. So international aid has largely been spurned, which is one of the main complaints.
I thought we'd sent about $10 million. I thought we sent about $10 million in aid there. It's not gotten
the government's official. The government's official line has been to keep all aid from coming through. There have been back channels that have gone in through various states, but even $10 million in a country of 40 million people or 30-some-odd million people, that's not...
No, it's a drop in the bucket.
Much. Yeah. It's not even a drop in the barrel, so to speak. And that's something that I think is going to continue to be a problem.
Daniel, let me thank you. We'll have to leave it there. We're going to meet Adam Schiff when we return. Daniel Lansbury-Rodriguez, again, is adjunct lecturer in finance at Northwestern and also columnist for the Venezuelan newspaper El Nacional.